Please turn back with me, if you will, to Joshua chapter 5. We'll be looking at this story this morning. Chapter 5 actually ends the first major section of the book of Joshua. That session was preparation to enter into the land. And if you remember back in chapter 1, we began with God's commission of Joshua to be strong and courageous, to obey all the commands of God. And if he does that, things will go well for him. That God will never leave him. No man will be able to stand against him, as we just sang those words, in all the days of his life. In chapter 2, we come to a beautiful picture of God's grace in the lives of all who believe, in the story of Rahab the prostitute, going from walking in the darkness to walking in the light. And God is building through that story, I believe, the faith of Israel, as he does in chapters 3 and 4. Last week, we talked about the miraculous crossing of the Jordan River and how God did that for him, and God led them across that river during the time of flooding, building the faith of the Israelites, preparing them to take the land that he had promised to them. And that is the situation that leads up to chapter 5. God had just led them across a river that was impossible to cross. They have a leader in Joshua who obeys God. He led them. He gave the commands of God to the priest and to the people, and they followed him. Joshua is not a weak man. You know, we talked about him being Moses' assistant, but he was actually a military leader. In Exodus chapter 17, remember the story of Israel defeats Amalek, and in verse 13 it says, "And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword." This is the leader that is taking Israel into the promised land. He's one of two people left from the older generation. He was Moses' assistant, but more than that, he is now God's servant. They have been a band of ex-slaves, of desert wanderers with simple weaponry, no chariots, no horses, but God is on their side. And the armies of the Lord are on their side. Even though the armies of the land are at a low point in their morale, that just adds to their faith. Not only has Rahab affirmed that in chapter 2, verse 9, when she says this, and said to the men, "I know the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water in the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, of Sihon and Og, who you devoted to destruction." And then we come to chapter 5 in verse 1, and we read these words: "As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until now, they had crossed over, their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them." Why? Because of the people of Israel. Now is the time to attack. We've crossed the Jordan miraculously. The people are melting as wax melts from a candle. Now is the time to attack. Things have become dramatically depressing for the nations they will attack. Even so, those nations probably thought they had, you know, a few more weeks, maybe a couple of months until the flood season ended and Israel would be able to cross. But now Israel's on the west side, on their side of the land, on their side of the river, just a few miles from Jericho. Now is the time to attack. And so we read in verse 2, at that time, the Lord said to Joshua, charge. No, doesn't say that, does it? It says, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel. Make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel. What's going on here? What is the purpose of these events in chapter 5? The one thing I hope we take away from this today is simply this: that holy living before a holy God comes before holy war. Holy living before a holy God comes before holy war. I don't care how you said it. Pastors have said this over and over in many different ways: dedication before delivery, consecration before conquest, worship before warfare. All of those are true. Spiritual preparation comes before the battle. The Lord prepares his people spiritually so that they might enter into the life of his promises. Holy living before a holy God comes before holy war. Just like last week, this chapter contains three scenes. We looked at three scenes from the crossing, and now three scenes in the preparation, the story of circumcision, Passover, and the commander of the Lord's army. Three scenes to help us understand this simple truth. There are two signs, or two signs of belonging, or two religious rituals, and there's a divine appearance. Verses 1 through 9, there's circumcision. We're going to learn from that the promises of God are absolute. Then in verses 10 through 12, the Passover. The provisions of God are abundant. And in verses 13 through 15, worship. The presence of God gives assurance. So let's look at those three things, beginning in verses 2 through 9. Circumcision, the promises of God are absolute. It's not take Jericho, but it's take a flint knife and circumcise every male. Talk about cutting off a soldier's morale. I don't even know how to handle this part. Gibeath Haraloth literally means a hill of foreskins. There were at least 1 million people. Half of those were at least of soldier age, 20 years or older. Then you have all the boys from 8 days to 20 years. I'm just going to leave that right there. But I will say it's probably not named that before this event. Last week after the service, I was talking with Bob, and we were talking about the sermon, and he said, so next week's Gilgal. And I thought, Bob likes the story of Gilgal. And I said, yeah, circumcision. And he said to me, I think that's the greatest display of faith in Scripture. And, you know, I thought about that. I thought that's a pretty bold statement. I mean, I think of Noah building an ark when he didn't know what rain was. I think of Abraham willing to sacrifice his son and having faith God would provide. I think of Elijah. You go and we're going to have some birds feed you. And then you go to a widow who has nothing to cook for you. And she's going to make you cakes. And we can go on and on. There are many others. And I thought, why this particular story? Well, let me share with you very briefly why I think there's truth in that statement. In Genesis chapter 34, In Genesis chapter 34, we have another story. It's the defiling of Dinah, and it begins this way. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. He raped her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke tenderly of her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor and said, get me this girl for my wife. He's apparently a nice rapist, apparently, or his heart turned toward her. And so what happens in that story? The sons of Jacob wanted to kill their daughter's perpetrator. And so when Jacob spoke with his father, he went to his sons, and in verse 13, it says, the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, and we want every male to be circumcised, and then we will intermarry, and we will give her as your wife. Of course, that was deceit. Why? Verse 25, on the third day, when they were sore, still on the third day after circumcision, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came to the against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. What does that tell me? It tells me circumcision is serious for an adult male. You cannot get up to even defend yourself, and two sons can kill the whole city. That's why this is a story of great faith. The Jordan River was at their backs, and the Jordan River was at flood stage. There's no turning back now. Seven nations in front of them with bigger and better armies. To be circumcised would disable the entire army, and yet they submitted. They had seen the hand of God in crossing the Jordan. They had been led by the servant of God, Joshua, and they believe the promises of God, and they say, we'll do it. And instead of army readiness, they would be in army recovery for 7 days. Not confrontation, but circumcision. Any army could come in and destroy them. This was a call to not rely on their own power, not to rely on their own battle readiness, but to rely on the promises of God and to rely on the work of God that they had seen in their life and the faith that God had built through what he had seen. Verses 4 through 7, we're told the reason why the circumcision was needed. Verse 2 tells us this was the second circumcision. That doesn't mean all these guys were circumcised the first time. What it means is they were not circumcised since the first circumcision, which was before the wilderness wandering. And we find in verses 4 through 7 that the reason they needed to be circumcised is that because when they were in the wilderness, there was not a circumcision. Why? Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but there have been speculation. Some say it was because they were constantly on the move, and to be circumcised, you'd have to be in bed for 7 days and before you can move. But that's not really a good argument, because there were long periods of time when they did not go anywhere than where they could have been circumcised. Others say that it was possibly unclean to do that and dangerous for your health, because you're in the dust and you're in the dirt and you don't have the right equipment to do it. And so maybe that was the reason that they did not circumcise. But I think the real reason that we see that they were not circumcised is in verse 6, and it at least gives us a clue. For the people of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished. Why? Because they did not obey the voice of the Lord. The Lord swore to them that they would not, he would not let them see the land that he had promised them. I believe that is the reason, or at least it's a good possibility of the reason that they were not circumcised. They had disobeyed God, and God had withdrawn his blessing from them. Because what is circumcision? Well, circumcision is part of the covenant of Abraham. In Genesis 17, God said, this is the covenant, but there's going to be a sign. There's going to be a symbol that you are part of this covenant. And the symbol is circumcision. The Mosaic covenant had Sabbath as a sign. The Noahic covenant had the rainbow, you remember, as a sign of the covenant of God. But for the Abrahamic covenant, on the eighth day of a male child, he would be circumcised as a sign of the covenant. What does that mean? Well, some have said the male organ is an organ of life. The symbol of cutting away is the cutting away of fleshly desires, that we not only sin, but we have been born in sin. David said, I have been brought from sin from the time my mother conceived. I have been born into sin. Circumcision then is a symbolic cutting away of fleshly desires to serve only the Lord. Let me show you that in Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 12. We see the real meaning of this symbol of circumcision. Deuteronomy 10, verse 12, and now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. That's the gospel, isn't it? God loves them, and now they are to obey. And to keep the commandments and the statutes of the Lord, which I will command you for your good. Behold, the Lord your God behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth and all that is in it. Yet the Lord set his heart in love on your fathers and chose their offspring after them, you above all people, as you are this day. Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and be no longer stubborn. For the Lord your God is a God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great and mighty and the awesome God who is not partial and takes no bribes. What is he saying? He's saying circumcise your heart. This is a symbol, but it's an outward symbol of an inner change. And you are to be dedicated to the Lord wholeheartedly. Now, don't miss the irony here. The first generation, circumcised, disobeyed, died. The second generation, not circumcised, God raises them up in verse 7, and they obey. You can have all the marks of the people of God, but lack the faith and the response of the people of God. Circumcision, being circumcised, but no faith. Baptized, take part of the Lord's table, but no faith. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 5, we read these words. Now these things, Let me start up a little bit further. In verses 1 through 5, 4, he gives a warning of idolatry. And verse 5 says, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased. The people coming out of Egypt, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up and to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. What is he talking about? Well, look in verse 1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them. That rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased. What is he saying here? He's saying, this is the experience of the Exodus. Everyone ate the manna. Everyone drank from the rock and remained in unbelief. You see, membership to a church without Christ is like having a cross without Christ. It's professing the sovereignty of God while living under the sovereignty of myself. In verses 8 and 9 of Joshua chapter 5, says this, and when this whole nation, the circumcising of the whole nation was finished, they remained in the place in the camp until they were healed, and said, the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So the name of that place is called Gilgal to today. What's the lesson? The reproach was rolled away. I think that means the reproach of their unbelief. Some will say it's the reproach of being slaves in Egypt. Maybe that's part of it. But I think it's the reproach of not going into the promised land the first time when they were at Kadesh Barnea. It was the lack of faith, and that's been rolled away. Why? Because God fulfills his promises. So we need to live as people we are, as children of God. Because two times we read in these verses, Yahweh swore. Yahweh swore that the first generation would not go in, but he swore that the land would be theirs. Did the negative promise negate the positive? No. What is he saying? Yahweh swore. Yahweh swore. God will build his kingdom regardless of man. And man is powerless to stop him. Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. As circumcision came before the conflict for Israel, so does spiritual circumcision come before the spiritual battles that you and I face in our lives. We need to believe the promises of God and we need to live them. Because his promises are absolute, and we will not stop his promises. He goes on, verses 10 through 12, a shorter section talking about Passover. The provisions of God are abundant. The first Passover in Canaan, circumcision was a requirement of Passover, so that had to come first. This is really the completion of the redemption that started in Egypt 40 years ago. 40 years earlier. And now, in a sense, it's being completed with this generation. They're no longer slaves. They're no longer wanderers, but they are free in the land where they will find rest. What's the point of this? I think the point is that God has provided for 40 years, and God continues to provide. That the big point of verses 10 through 12 seems to be God's provision. Why? Because three times he says what? He says, and they ate. They ate the produce of the land. And they ate the fruit of the land. God's provisions are abundant. I love this verse. I love eating. They ate. That's a good day. That is a good day. But you know, the manna stopped. But God's provisions did not stop. God provided extraordinarily in an extraordinary time when they were in the wilderness. But we come to the land that he's promised, and God provides in ordinary ways. Whether it's manna from heaven or crops from the ground, both are God's provisions for his people. Don't miss the provisions of God in life. We think of things like, I was in a terrible car accident, the car was totaled, but I didn't receive any injury. Well, that's God's protection. That's God's provision for you. Or we think, the cancer is in remission. Oh, God is providing for you. We escaped two category 4 or 5 hurricanes and no one died, and that's God's provision. And that is all true. But what about the thousands of safe trips that you make to work in your lifetime? That is a provision of God. What about all the years of health that God has given to you? That is God's provision. One theologian put it this way, that most of God's gifts to people are not dazzling and gaudy, but wrapped in a simple brown bag. Getting to work safely on I-75 every day. Healthy kids running around the house. A job with a regular paycheck. Supper with family. Wise advice from someone in your life group. Just out of ordinary living. Those are the ordinary provisions of God. Don't miss those. We used to sing a song, Count Your Blessings, Name Them One by One. Some of you older folks know that song. And you will see what God has done. Charles Spurgeon said this, we have all things and abound. Not because I have a good store of money in a bank, not because I have skill and wit with which to win my bread, but because the Lord is my shepherd. The Lord provides for his sheep. Don't miss the ordinary provisions of God. They're abundant. Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 7 says this. For the Lord your God is bringing you into the land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs flowing out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper, and you shall eat and be full, and you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land he has given you. That is what God is fulfilling. This is the first time they have eaten of the fruit of the land. All the farmers are gone. They're probably behind the walls of Jericho because they have melted. How much wheat and barley does it take to make bread for 1 million people? That is the land. That is the abundance of the provisions of God, Jehovah Jireh, God, our provider. And this is a foretaste of what they would experience in the land. And how much more for us? And we come to verses 13 through 15. It's all about worship. The presence of God gives assurance. Gilgal is thought to be east of Jericho, just a few miles, not far away. So they're not far away from where the first battle will take place. Joshua appears to be looking around, maybe doing some reconnaissance, or maybe he's out for a walk thinking, now what? Now what do we do? Here we are. So how are we going to do this? He had a fortified city in Jericho facing him, and a man with a sword stands in front of him. And Joshua says, this is probably like Joshua did when he saw this guy. And Joshua said, are you for us or are you against us? No. Joshua's probably thinking, well, it wasn't really a yes, no question. And he just simply said, I am the commander of the army of Jehovah. I have come. In other words, I'm in charge now. This is my battle. And Joshua fell on his face and worshiped. Why that reaction? Well, first of all, I got to think it's been that's a huge relief to Joshua, for one thing, a huge comfort that a man of war was about to go to war for him. Ultimately, Joshua is not responsible for this battle. But there's another army, an army much better prepared than Israel's ragtag group of wanderers with their animals and their wives and their children in tow. Who was this man? He doesn't fit Joshua's category, does he? Is he for us or against us? Well, no. And then the man says this, take off your sandals. Joshua had heard those words before, probably from Moses telling him about the time of the burning bush that we talked about in the Bible study hour this morning. Joshua knew that story. Moses and the burning bush, when God appeared to Moses, I think this was not a theophany, but a Christophany, an appearance of Christ. What's the purpose of this theophany? Well, I don't think it was to teach war strategy, at least not at this point. The purpose seems to be to cause holy submission, to so strike Joshua with awe that he falls on his face and worships. And that's what he did. Worship comes before war. Holy living before a holy God comes before holy war. What's the lesson for us? I think that's this, that we need to see God for who he is. Not that he's not on our side, but we don't need to, it's not the first question, is it? But we need to see him as a sovereign Lord of all the earth. More often we want to know, more often we want to know, God, what's your plan, rather than God, who are you? We want to know God's plan more than his position. The proper question would have been not, was he on their side, but were they on his side? Holy living before holy God comes before holy war. The question is not whose side is God on. The real question is whose side am I on? The question for us is, whose side are you on and whose side am I on? The question is not, what's God going to do for me today, but what am I going to do for God today? The main actor in the story is God. It's not Joshua. Yahweh determines the destiny of Israel. It's in his will and it's in his power to take the land for Israel. This is his promise. God brings rest to Israel. Joshua simply falls down before a holy God in submission. There are three scenes in the story, and I think there are three types of people here today. You're either living in the absolute promises of God, enjoying the grateful abundance of his provision, and worshiping in holy submission before God, and if you are, keep fighting that fight. Or you're not doing that. Life is hard, and for whatever reason, you've taken your eyes off God and you put them on the circumstances, and you're thinking, God, whose side are you on? And life seems overwhelming. The promises are not absolute to you anymore. The provisions are not abundant, and well, life of worship just seems to fade. It might look good on the outside. The facade looks good, but you're losing the battle in your private life. Private spiritual victories come from private visits with a holy God. Or you don't know this God at all. You don't know who fights your battles. You fight them. You don't know the one who gives hope. You give yourself whatever hope you can. But you want that life because you're tired and you're weary, and Matthew 11 applies to you. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I pray if that's your case, you would seek us out. You would fill out a connection card and put it in the plate and drop it off and let us talk to you and help you with that. But as we celebrate the table this morning, we do this until the Lord comes. May the Holy Spirit today convict each of us, wherever we are, whatever one of those three people we are, and may we make the appropriate response, because God gives us the faith to do that. Let's pray together.